This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I'm sick with this. I'm sick with this. Since you wasn't a fun, lost judgment. My own sweet down to the 24. I don't recognize you for this.
Is up, my sinners. Welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome, a podcast where I, Shane Told, your host with the most, your man with usually not much of a plan, has conversations with other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band. And this week baseball starts. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And as some of you may know, I'm a huge sports guy, with baseball being the very top, so I'm very excited, and I think my Blue Jays have a shot this year. I think, you know, I mean, the Yankees and Red Sox are looking very good in the AL East, but I think the Blue Jays have a shot at maybe, you know, sneaking in there in a wild card spot. Great rotation, improved outfield. We shall see. But I celebrate baseball just in general. I'm going to be at the Tigers home opener on Thursday. Couple Miller High Lives, veggie burger. Oh yeah, I cannot wait. But hey, the podcast, and why you're here, this week's show, hell yes. It was such a treat for me. I absolutely loved this conversation. We have a progressive metal legend on the show this week, Mr. James LaBrie of the one and only Dream Theater. And seriously, what a band. Does it get any more wild musically than what Dream Theater does? Seriously. But for this episode, we talk about the vocal side of the band. And believe me, I think it is far more interesting. So get ready for this. I think my favorite one so far. Before we get into that, I have a big shout out to Paul Romero, straight out of California. Northern California, to be exact. Ladies, he is single. And he says he's pretty. So keep a lookout for that. But seriously, Paul Romero, thank you for the love and support. It means the world to me. Also, big shout out to all the members of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. We've been getting a ton of new members, which is awesome to see. Check it out, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. If you need more episodes, more interaction with me, a great community of other fans, we discuss everything in the Facebook group. And of course, more perks like free merch, Q&A session with me, and much, much more. And it starts for as little as $6 a month. That is like less than 3 Chipotle guacamole upgrades. Okay? So you got this. You got this. So again, check it out. LeadsingerSyndrome.com/all access. And of course, we are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff. Be sure to add us. We have some incredible episodes coming up in the next few weeks. I've been busy. I've been recording shit like all week. It has been nuts, but so good. So make sure you're subscribed. Whatever you're listening to this on, just boop, hit the subscribe button. I don't want you missing anything at all. Before we jump in, as usual, big shout out to our sponsor, Rockabilia.com, the absolute best in the band merchandise business. If you need anything, again, weather's getting nice. Maybe you need like a little spring windbreaker or something, or a t-shirt, depending on where you live. Maybe you're still wearing a hoodie. I don't know. But hey, check it out, rockabilia.com. They got everything. They got 500,000 unique items. Everything is officially licensed from the band, so you don't have to worry about any crappy knockoffs or print being offset, or you put it in the wash and it fades. We got good quality stuff here at rockabilia.com. And of course, we have a promo code to save 15% off your entire order. The promo code is PCJabberJaw, J-A-B-B-E-R-J-A-W, PCJabberJaw. So head over to rockabilia.com, pick up a couple things for you, for a loved one, and use that promo code PCJabberJaw to save 15% today. All right, hey, I want to get into this. No more wasting any more time. I absolutely love this conversation. So here it is, this week's episode and my conversation with James LaBrie of Dream Theater. Hello.
How you doing, Shane?
I'm doing fantastic. So nice to speak to you.
Yes, same here.
Yeah, absolutely. Man. This is kind of wild how this got set up. I mean, it was actually a message I got through your son's bandmate, who's a big fan of my band, kind of mentioned you in passing, and I said, I got to get this guy in the show because I've been a huge fan of their band since you joined the band. So this is kind of crazy that this worked out, and here we are talking. How are you on this fine, what is it, Thursday? How you doing?
Yeah, no, I'm doing great. Yep, I'm just enjoying the weather, and I'm going to get outside a little more here.
Where are you living? Sorry?
Where are you located?
Well, I'm based in Toronto. Okay. That's where I grew up. Right now I'm in Windsor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what about yourself?
So I'm up around the Midland area.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I saw the 705 number. Yeah. And I know you grew up out that way too, right? Out in Northern Ontario.
I grew up in Midland. Yeah.
In Midland. That's crazy. And it's funny because I think, obviously Dream Theater being a band that everyone knows is like New York, a lot of people don't know that you're Canadian.
Yeah, it's surprising after all these years, that I still get people and they go, hang on a second, what? You're from Canada? And I'm like, yeah, if you go on the site, it's kind of, that's if you want to spend the time and surf around or whatever, browse around. I mean, then that becomes apparent where I'm from. But I guess most people, they just look at it and they say, it's a New York band, so everyone's American, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, your story of getting into the band is a pretty cool story. They went through like 200 audition people or something to find you. But when they did get you and get you in the band, were there hoops because you're Canadian to kind of, you had to get a visa or whatever? I mean, I guess it was a long time ago.
Well,
but
initially, believe it or not, Shane, I mean, when I first went down there, I actually flew down the day the Desert Storm started in 1991.
Wow.
And I remember I was getting on an American Airlines plane, and I still remember just, in the recesses of my mind thinking, holy jeez, they just started a big war here. And here I am flying American Airlines going down into the States. It was kind of surreal, everything that was kind of like lined up in that particular day. And then I'm meeting these guys and I've never met them before, although I think we've got something going on that will definitely work. And so initially when I got down there, it was only for me to come down and jam with them. And right after the first jam, it was quite apparent that we had something going on.
Yeah.
And we jumped right into recording a demo the very next day. And we recorded, four songs. And then right from there, it was a matter of, getting the label behind us and then getting, everything formed up and firmed up to actually get us in the studio to start recording Images and Words, which didn't start until October 91. But I didn't get my visa. Believe it or not, I was down there the whole time just kind of like chilling because I wasn't really working. Yeah,
Right.
I was down there recording, but I wasn't getting paid or anything like that. At that point, it was just a matter of let's get this album recorded and let's get it out there and then we can start touring. And then once we knew the tour was going to start, which was in September of 92, then I had you know, the work visa and all that stuff. But I made it really clear to the guys as soon as I had met them. And like they, like I said, the day after I got there, we started demoing. And then the day after we started demoing, they said, you know, hey, we want you in the band, you know, are you into it? And I said, absolutely. You know, guys, you guys are phenomenal players. And I, and the music that we're going to record for Images is just incredible. So, yeah. I, you know, I said, it's a no brainer. I want to be in the band, but I have to tell you this, I'm not moving down here. I want to stay up where I am. At the time I was living in Toronto.
Yeah.
I was around the area of, Pharmacy in Eglinton.
Okay. So right yeah.
There. Yeah. But I lived in like four different areas of Toronto the whole time. Cause I lived down there for about 10 years. And, but anyways, and they were like, whatever, you know, that's not a problem because you're only, at the time, it was only a 50-minute flight.
Yeah.
You know, to go from Toronto Pearson into LaGuardia. So it wasn't a big deal. Yeah.
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 Yeah. No, that's wild. I mean, it seems like things moved so quickly. You know, like all of a sudden they want a guy, they get a guy. All right, let's record. Let's,
yeah.
You know, it seemed like, I mean, I guess to say that Dream Theater is a very professional band would maybe be an understatement.
Yeah.
Like you can't craft, you know, music do without a lot of preparation.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'll tell you the irony there, Shane, is that whenever we get together and we're in the studio and we're writing for, you know, a new album or whatever it might be. We're never, ever shy on ideas. We're never short on ideas. There's tons of ideas. In fact, if you were to go back through the various albums, there's so much material that, you know, that could have easily become a great song. And then it's just kind of like tossed to the side. And we always say that we're going to come back and revisit those songs or yeah. those ideas, those seeds or whatever you want to call it.
Sure, sure.
And you never do because by the time you're in a position to be writing again and working on a new album, there's, you know, I mean, I've always said that we are, you know, a reflection of what's going on at that particular moment in time. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all influenced by what is going on our lives on a personal level, on a social level, you know, politics, everything. You know, we're massively influenced by that on a continual basis. And I really think it's like looking into a crystal ball each album. If you look at each album from a band, you can tell pretty much what was going on in the world at the time, or at least what those guys, that collection of musicians, were going through personally.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's your telling, is that that's where you were at that particular moment. But
well, you know, yeah. you bring up things like, you know, the Gulf War in 1991, which was also, you know, that's when the grunge era started and all that, and that, you know, that war and depression, like it did breed that. And if you look
Absolutely.
At history and music, you know, I mean, I'm not just talking about the obvious stuff like the Beatles and Give Peace a Chance and all that. I'm talking right. about, you know, just even in modern day, you know,
yeah.
what's happening.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's you know, it's funny because, you know, we go to the news and that to kind of gauge what's going on globally. But I mean, if you were to listen to enough bands, you know, there's so much, you know, prolific tellings of exactly what it is that we're all feeling, or what, you know, is the consensus as to what we feel the situation is currently, you know. But
definitely.
Yeah, it's always been that. But I mean, you know, the whole thing, you know, as fast as Dream Theater came along, and this is what a lot of people ask me, they go, well, you know, like you were able to, you know, jump into Dream Theater. And I go, well, yeah, I said, you know, it's always timing with that, because I was in several bands before I hooked up with Dream Theater, and the last band being Winter Rose down in Toronto. And we were out, and that's how that whole Dream Theater thing came along, was that I was out touring with Winter Rose, which was a band myself and Rich Chickie, who happens to have been the engineer and has mixed the last three or the last two Dream Theater albums.
Wow.
But him and I, we had this band called Winter Rose, and it was great. You know, it was more in the vein of, you know, like Whitesnake meets Skid Row meets,
sure.
you know,
yeah.
like Aerosmith and stuff like that. But it was really cool stuff, very melodically driven. And we were out with Lee Aaron. I don't know if you remember her.
I remember, absolutely remember her, yeah.
So, you know, the old metal queen, Lee Aaron. Yeah. And she came up to me, and she's the one that pretty much was instrumental in orchestrating that get-together with Dream Theater, just because she sent, unbeknownst to me, she sent the disc that we had down to these people that she knew in New York, who happened to be, it was MCA Records, who also happened to be with Dream Theater. And they knew that Dream Theater was looking for a singer, so they heard that tape, and they were like, holy shit, you know, we got to get this over to the guys and see if they, at all they're interested. Then they heard it, and then that's, you know, everything else after that is history as we know it.
Absolutely, but I mean, the band couldn't have been that big at the time. I mean, they had one record under their belt, and they lost their singer, but it seems like, you know, they had, maybe they just had a lot of backing through the label, or something at the time, but it seems like it was like you knew this band was going to be, I mean, you probably didn't know it was going to be 25 years later doing an anniversary tour, but you had a feeling that this band was something special, I guess, and a lot of people knew it.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, they put out When Dream and Day Unite, and I think the best thing that came from that was critical acclaim. You know, magazines around the world were noting that these guys were, you know, a force to be reckoned with musically. Because you have to remember, when they put out When Dream and Day Unite in 1989, like, those guys were like 21, 22 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be playing that kind of music at that level and putting together the compositions that they did was, you know, a little precocious. Nowadays it's the norm. I mean, I can't believe the musicianship out there today is just, it's phenomenal. And it's scary, you know. Right. But at the time, you know, the one thing that it garnered for them was that magazines around the world and the music industry became aware of this band. They didn't really sell much at all because, you know, just due to the nature of that music, you know, it's either you're hitting a stride or people are made – to become aware of you because of a radio hit or something. And so going in Images and Words, you know, to be honest with you, none of us, you know, we all believed that this album had everything that it could possibly have to really draw some massive attention, but was it going to get its fair shake? Yeah. And none of us knew. And, you know, fortunately for us, let's face it, I don't know if you and I would be having this conversation today if it hadn't been for Pull Me Under going through the roof. And I've said that all along. Sure. You know, that was the catalyst that presented a platform for us to be able to, or a wave, a tidal wave, to be able to ride and bring us into the subsequent albums and be known worldwide, you know, on a very big level.
Well, yeah. It's, you know, that song was the first one I ever heard. You know, it's funny, you know, my sister is about 7 years older than me.
Okay.
And so, whenever that record came out, I guess it was 1992, I was 11 years old. And jeez. And oh, I used God. To sneak into my sister's...
So was I, Shane.
Hey, I feel old. I feel old now that, you know, thinking about that record being 25 years old. I can't even imagine how you feel, my friend.
Oh, my God, man. It's just surreal, for sure.
But I would sneak into her room when she wasn't home. And, you know, CDs at the time were kind of like a new thing. You know, they were kind of the fancy new thing. And she had Images and Words, and you know, which was kind of funny because my sister wasn't into anything proggy at all. I think she might have had a Rush record, you know, and then she liked things like Depeche Mode and Erasure and like music like that. But I put that record on, and it was like, what is this music? You know, like, what is going on? Like this like, I remember the first time I heard, I guess it's Metropolis on that record.
Yeah,
part one. When you go in that big long instrumental break, and it's the accents, you know, in that part, and I just remember thinking to myself, like, even as an 11-year-old kid, that I think I just picked up a guitar for the first time, I couldn't believe that someone could write music like that. Like, it blew my mind.
Yeah,
you know, I'd never heard anything like that, and still to this day, when I throw on that record, and it still sounds great. By the way, I throw it on and
it really was. Produced album for sure.
Yeah, Sonic. And I still, it still blows my mind, you know, after all this time, you know, it's crazy. How was doing that tour, that anniversary tour?
Yeah, well, you had that same kind of reaction that I had, because I grew up massively influenced by Rush. And and when I heard, you know, A Farewell to Kings or Fly By Night or Hemispheres, I remember just sitting there in my room and playing those albums over and over again and just being blown away, you know, just by the fact that, you know, each guy in the band, you know, I've always said that Alex Lifeson is the most underrated freaking guitar player in the world because he's phenomenal. He's a phenomenal player, an amazing writer. I mean, you know, writing with Getty and Neil, you know, everyone said everything that can be possibly said about Neil, you know, as a drummer. And, you know, but, you know, and then the other major influence, Queen, you know, being Freddie Mercury was just a mind-blowing experience from the first note that he sang to the last, you know. And so, you know, all these things, I totally get what you're saying, you know, that you are, you have albums that left an indelible mark on you, you know, and that can be what formed or was the one element that was, or one of the several elements that is responsible for who you are today as a musician.
Right. Right. Well, and you guys are covering Rush now. Didn't you just come out with a cover not too long ago? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Xanadu. Yeah.
And that's,
that was a lot of fun, but I also did Red Barchetta back quite some years ago. And, you know, and Bytor and the Snow Dog and stuff like that. I sang that on an album that came out, was called Working Man. And I had a lot of fun doing that. I did a little spin of my own on Red Barchetta. So you can always check that out too.
Let's check it out.
Yeah.
So yes, this, the 25th anniversary tour of Images and Words, what was it like going back, revisiting those songs? Some of them you probably haven't played in years. And you know, the fans coming out, knowing you're going to play this whole record and everything, the energy, the vibe, the memories, what was that like for you?
You know, that's exactly what it did. It started to conjure up all these memories of when we were initially out touring it, because that's what it brought back. It was like, okay, you know, like throughout the years we played, you know, maybe a couple songs from Images here and there. On our 15th anniversary, we played the whole album, but we only did it once. And then we moved on again, and we, you know, continued with whatever we were playing on that particular tour. But, you know, to have actually gone out, and we were playing like 3 hours a night. So the first set would be songs from the various albums. And then the second set would all be dedicated to Images and Words. And then the encore was A Change of Seasons. So it was a very long evening.
But to say the least.
It started to, because you were playing the album just like we did when we were out on the Images and Words tour, we played the album from beginning to end, just like it was in the same sequence, you know, as the album is on disc. And so it started to bring up, you know, we all started to sit around the tour bus and started to talk about, oh my God, you remember that? Like we were back in a van, you know, bouncing around the road. You know, and then staying in flea-bitten hotels and playing dives, and you know, until Pull Me Under hit, and then everything completely changed for us. But yeah, you know, and it was interesting, because when you play that material, you just realize, like, you're kind of reminded of, you know, I guess that album really does still have a special place with each and every one of us, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, and I mean, it doesn't, not to take away from any of the other albums, you know, like to me, I still am very passionate about Scenes from a Memory and 6 Degrees of Inner Turbulence. You know, those albums still have a very loud resonance with me, you know. And so it's kind of, I remember like John Bertucci just saying, holy shit, man, you know. Like, do you remember being in the studio and David Prater was the producer at the time.
Uh-huh.
And he also mixed the album. And he said, do you remember like sitting around the control room? We were talking about it. And David was sitting there and he's going, yeah, you know, guys, I got to tell you, you know, I really feel that this is going to do something for you guys. And it's going to go on a global scale. And, you know, at the time, you just kind of, yeah, Okay. I hope, you know, from your lips to God's ears, right? That's what you say.
Yeah.
But is it really going to happen? Like, it was anyone's guess. And you have to remember, you just mentioned earlier there, Shane, you said, you know, 91, 92, well, grunge was at its peak.
Yeah.
So here we come out with an album like Images and Words. It was like, really? Where do we fit in?
And sure.
Right? And the label, you know, God love them, because they were like, no, you know, we're going to do this. You know, we're going to get out there and we're going to push this and we're going to see what happens. We're going to see if it sticks. And thankfully for us, what happened was Pull Me Under, the college radio stations at all the colleges around the state started playing this song, and it blew up. And because it blew up at college radio, then all of a sudden all the national radio stations went, hey, hang on a second. What's going on here? They grabbed it, and the same thing happened there. So, you know.
Well, for every movement, there's an anti-movement in the same way, too. And there's people that, there's like, I mean, a lot of people love Nirvana. But at that time, a lot of people were like, what is this bullshit?
Yeah.
No one talks about those people, but they were there. Right. And people didn't want to let go of the 80s, you know, and some of the music and some of the fashion and a lot of the things that you guys in some ways, I mean, image wise, you guys still had, you know what I mean? And I think that there were still people that really wanted to hang on to that.
Well, you know, I think what happens is anything that I think should be listened to, or anything that is very unique and original, is always at the same time jarring. Like you just mentioned Nirvana. And like they came out, and at first people were like, what the hell's going on here? You know, it's like me walking down the street and someone has their garage door open and I'm listening to a band rehearsing.
Yeah.
But you know, it was much more than that. Let's face it.
Some
of the songs are brilliant. You know, they're just brilliant, and that's why it did stick. And the same goes for something like a band like ours. And, you know, at first it was jarring, I'm sure, to many people. But then if they actually sat down and started listening to it, they're going, hey, wait a minute, I get it. I get where this is coming from. I'm sure there's still many people that don't get it. But at the same time, there were many people that did enough for it to be able to, you know, provide a very lucrative deal for each and every one of us, or career, I should say.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
With your band, you know, and you talk about the differences between Nirvana and Dream Theater as if we're comparing these bands, first of all, which is very funny. Yeah. But, you know,
the antithesis of music, right?
but I mean, obviously your band is known for, you know, technical prowess and, you know, virtuosos and all that stuff. And John is on the cover of Guitar World this month.
Right, yeah.
You know, congratulations to him and what a career he's had. I know he's out doing the guitar nerd tour,
E3.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
E3.
You know, and you know, it makes it, a question I want to ask you is, when you guys are in the studio, whatever you're working on, how much of the band is, okay, we have to write a great song, we have to say something, we have to, you know, put this out for our fans that care about, you know, the songs and the music, and how much of it is like, well, this part has to be like super sick and I have to play like maybe something very difficult and challenging for myself, and do you know what I mean? For kind of, you know, quote unquote, the nerds.
Yeah, I think what happens is, you know, the way that I've seen it always unfold, and my observation is this, that, you know, we'll get in there and initially we all have like ideas and we'll sit around and we'll listen to them and here's, you know, the seeds and that. And then the other, so we can like build on that and we can cultivate. But then the other part of it is just, you know, someone comes in, whether it might be Mike playing a beat on the drums, you know, and it's rhythmically very inspiring. And then all of a sudden John comes in and starts playing a riff around it. And then Jordan joins in, and then John Mayung joins in. And a lot of that happens too. But I think, you know, what you were asking there, like, when do you see yourself becoming, you know, okay, guys, so this is where we're going to get real crazy instrumental.
Yeah.
And what some people might refer to as superfluous noodling and stuff like that. I think that it actually, it naturally presents itself. You know, you just know that, wait a second, where we've just taken this and to the point that we are right now, it just makes absolute sense for the band at this point to go into something instrumental or to, you know, or a sick unison section or whatever. But it pretty much, you know, can just easily present itself along the way. There are moments when we're saying, you know, okay, well, this song, obviously, if it's an instrumental song, well, then, you know, anything's possible, right? At that point, sure. You're there to make it something that is so engaged instrumentally that right from the beginning to the end, you know, you still have to have the dynamics. I mean, you can't just be going at it 100% or 100 miles an hour from beginning to end, or else it becomes very monotone as far as I'm concerned.
Of course.
And monotonous. And so I think, you know, it depends on where we are, what we're doing, what kind of an environment we are in at that particular moment, writing wise, that kind of dictates where we're going to go with something. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, is it weird in some ways being the front man of the band and being, you know, the person that is the spokesperson of the band? You know, you talk between the songs and everything. But at the same time, you don't have as much of the spotlight on you because you aren't a shredder like Petrucci or Myung or Portnoy when he was in the band, you know?
Right.
What's that like for you?
No, you know what? To me, it's like, and I'm not trying to just throw myself in there to say, well, here, you know, what about me?
Right.
Because there's a time and a place for me to come in and go, okay, you know what, guys? Like, you know, I'm hearing this melody or I'm hearing this riff, you know, and so here it is. Take it or leave it. But you know, over the years, what you learn when you're in a band and is, you know, you all go through the growing pains. Every band goes through the growing pains where you feel like, you know, like your ego is basically promoting something that's not necessarily good. So you find yourself where you've gone through those moments where it's kind of like, well, what about me? And wait a second, I have to have a piece of this, or I have to be a part of this, or
right
to the point where you say, I'm only going to suggest, or I'm only going to involve myself if it makes sense. And I think, you know, so whether it be, you know, John Petrucci and Jordan riffing out on an idea and then Mike and John and I are sitting in the background, then so be it. Or if it's collectively all five of us just, you know, vibing on an idea and then it's going forward and it's going exactly as we envisioned it, then that's great too. But I think there's, you know, I think when the band is at a point where we can comfortably be sitting there and letting happen what is naturally happening and being good with that, then it's a very healthy environment. And then we all benefit from it because then we're putting our best foot forward. But with me, you know, like being just a singer amongst all these instrumentalists. Yeah. You know, and you know, it's been said in the press, like John has said it in the press. He goes, you know, I don't know how like James navigates his way through this at times because, you know, he's always kind of present, but he knows when to get involved. He knows when not to. He, you know, is eventually you're hearing him because he's singing on every one of the songs, whether I'm writing a lyric or whether I'm writing the melody. It doesn't really matter if what we've attained or at the end of it, we feel that the goal has been reached. But at this point it's pretty smooth.
Yeah.
And it's natural. But at one point it was kind of awkward because, like you said, you know, you're in a band with these types of players, and if you just threw them in a room and said go, well, then it would be like I would need a great big blowhorn there going, hey, wow, you know,
yeah,
stop. What about what I got to say? You know, because it's just it's unreal because they can just go, you know.
Sure.
And but it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
No, totally. I remember one time, like when I was a kid, my dad played the song Inagata Da Vida for me.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, yeah, I don't know how long it is. It's, you know, it's got to be like at least 15. Yeah. It's like a whole side of an LP, whatever, you know, whatever that is. Yeah. And I remember my dad, like he just loves the songs, like rocking out, you know, to it in the car. And I remember about halfway through going, where's the singer? What's the singer doing? Yeah. What does the singer do now during this part? Like, he's got a good 10 minutes to kill.
Oh my God,
in your band, that must happen. Like, you know,
sure it does.
What do you do during those long breaks?
Well, I don't know if you've ever noticed in a live, us on stage, but I have a tent. And so it's basically...
Trapdoor, bye.
Behind John Petrucci's amps, they have this thing that's set up. We call it the tent. But basically, it's like a three-sided, because the back is his amps, and it's a three-sided kind of like draped little cave for me to go into. And inside there, I have a seat. I have a humidifier. I have my warm water with honey, and I have just regular water. And then I can sit there, and while they're doing that, I'm just kind of like humming, just and doing stuff like that while they're doing that. And then just doing a little bit of stretching, and then sometimes depending on what it is they're going to do, like what section they're coming up to, or if they're going to do any solos or stuff like that, solo spotlights, I'll walk off the stage, and then I can be on the stage basically doing serious stretching or jumping jacks and stuff like that, just to kind of keep the blood going.
Yeah.
And then so that when I come out, it's not like I went and I sat down and I got really comfy as if the show was done. And then it's kind of hard to kind of bring back that energy, right? So I keep myself active while they're doing that.
Well, I guess it makes sense to have – I mean, not even make sense. It's almost a necessity when you're doing a three-hour show.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. Who can get up there and sing like you do for 3 hours straight without any breaks? Yeah. That would be impossible.
Yeah, it would be. I think it definitely would be. I mean, the average band plays, what, an hour and a half?
So
if you think about it, I mean, how many minutes of that is singing and so on? But, and that's why, you know, it's worked because we can do in a three-hour show, even in most – regular the songs the way that we kind of put together the set list, there are those breaks in there that allow me to kind of have that endurance, right?
Totally. Well, I mean, as you've gotten older, has your voice changed? I mean, surely it can't be getting easier, or has it?
Well, I mean, you know, I think you know, my voice, I'm not singing in the stratosphere like I did when I was, you know, on Images and Words. And when we went out with Images and Words, we tuned down just like a semitone.
Yeah.
And which is really not much, right? Like, let's face it.
Isn't it amazing, though, how much a semitone can make a difference in some songs?
It does.
Though? In some songs, it can blow your mind how much you're like, really? This is the same? This is only a semitone?
I know. It was mind-blowing. It definitely was mind-blowing. But it allowed me to, you know, to sing those songs and then go out every night and know that I'm not going to be just stretching it every night.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you know, you're aware, Shane, but you know, I had my a vocal rupture in 1994.
Yeah, I have it on my list of questions.
Yeah,
right here.
See, so the food poisoning there, I mean, I recovered. It took me probably close to like almost 7-8 years to fully recover. But even when I fully recovered from that, because I bled onto my vocal cords, which is, it can be, you know, a career ender. I remember seeing my ENT specialist, and she told me, she said, you know, like, oh my God, you know, you need to take 6 months off and just be quiet. And I said, I actually leave in 7 days for Tokyo because we were on the album. And she said, oh my God, I don't know what to tell you. She goes, you know, this is going to be extremely difficult for you. And she goes, I hope you don't do any further damage. And so, you know, long story short, I did get back, you know, I'd say 95% of my range. But I mean, where I used to be able to just go into the stratosphere, no problem, and scream my head off, I wasn't comfortable doing that anymore. Even though, I mean, since 94, I mean, there's been you know, many albums that show that I still had, you know, the range and all that stuff to go for it. But it wasn't like it was previous to the accident, where, you know, I could wake up and sing like Take the Time if I had to, or Child in Time from right. Deep Purple, you know. So it didn't matter back then. But, you know, you just have to learn how to adjust and you know, I guess accept where you are at that point as a vocalist and never push it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, no, it's scary stuff. I mean, yeah. Especially that, and that's pretty early in, you know, in your career. This is only, said 94, you'd only been in the band for a couple of years. So, I mean, after just 2 years, and I know you've done some touring with Winter Rose and some other bands, but, you know, you're still kind of finding your sea legs a little bit at that point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it doesn't just take like, oh, okay, I got through one US tour, I'm good to go. Yeah. You know, people take years and years and years to finally figure out, okay, this is what regiment I need to do to get through a show or get through a week of shows or a tour. So at that point, I mean, it must have been really hard for you, like just mentally, like personally.
Oh yeah, it was horrible. Let me put it to you this way: it was freaking horrible, is what it was. It was a very dark period in my life, you know, because it affected me. First of all, you got to remember, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but before that, I was able to just get up and sing like nothing, and it was effortless. And then all of a sudden, now I'm straining, now I'm cracking, my voice was cracking, and then it had become extremely fragile. So, you know, it was kind of like just waking up with a nightmare going on, you know, it was just. So, you know what, but I mean, you know, I had to say to myself, hey, either you got to toughen up here and you got to figure it out how you're going to do it. Because, I mean, we just, for example, we went out, when we finished this last tour in December, we had been out just shy of 2 years touring. So, you know, that's a lot of shows and each night 3 hours. And what happened to me a couple times on the tour is, you know, I got pretty sick. Like, you know, sinus infection, bad colds, flu, stuff like that. And then nowadays, it doesn't matter when you go out and then you say, okay, well, I'm only going to, you know, sing at 80%. And I got to like really watch myself here because I'm sicker than a dog. You got the trolls out on the internet and they're going, what the fuck is wrong with LaBrie? You know, like he couldn't handle it the other night. And then you're just sitting there. And at the end of the day, you're still a human being. You know, you got feelings and you're like, you get upset because you're going, you have no fucking idea what I was going through. And, you know, it's an organic instrument.
Yeah.
And you're trying to make the best of it. And it doesn't matter what singer I've talked to in the world, they've all gone through it and they've all had their, you know, I guess acrimonious, people that were, you know, cutting them up left, right, and center. And they're like, yeah, man, it's a freaking horrible situation. But you know what? Shane, the way I look at it is kind of whatever. You're not going to satisfy everyone. They don't necessarily have to know what you're going through. And if that makes them feel better by criticizing someone when they're down, so be it. If that's the kind of person they are, I hope to never sit around and I hope to never meet them, because someone like that is just shallow, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, a lot of people would look at your band and say, oh, LaBrie's got the easiest job.
Yeah.
But you don't.
No, absolutely.
You have the hardest job in the band. You do.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, and this is Lead Singer Syndrome Podcast, so we can talk about how hard our lives are. You know, but it's true. I mean, no matter what. Sorry, I lost you for a second. What'd you say?
No, I said, I'm sure that you've experienced some of that yourself when you had to perform and you're feeling like a bag of dirt.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. It happens. I'd say almost every tour, there's some point when I'm whether I'm sick, whether I've just kind of lost my voice or I'm not there or whatever. Right. Almost every tour, I'd say there's a period of time during it where I'm not feeling like not even close to 100%, like below 50%. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And and the show must go on, as the old adage says.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, well, you know what? We picked our instrument right. And you know what? I stand behind it 100%. Yeah, sure. I mean, we're not going to be 100% capacity all the time. But if you can sit back and say to yourself, hey, man, for the most part, I'm there, then that's all that matters.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot. I mean, you mentioned the word, you used the word prolific earlier in the conversation. And when you said the word prolific, I was like, prolific is James LaBrie. I mean, you've put out so many albums, not just with Dream Theater, but with, right, you know, other solo projects and stuff you've done. How have you found the time to do that? You must just never stop.
Yeah, I mean, well, and right now, you know, I'm working on another solo album, and so that's going on at the time or at the present. You know what, Shane? I mean, I just kind of look at the calendar and I see what I'm, you know, what's going on family wise, you know, because yeah. I do. I have a wife and two kids. I mean, my kids are older and 22 and 20, but still, you know, a family's a family. And then, it's just a balancing act. You got to be able to balance your personal life with your professional life. So I always look at it and go, okay, look at, can I do this? And can I dedicate the time that's necessary so that I can be proud of my involvement with whatever it is that I'm considering getting involved in, right, you know? And I think that's really the bottom line is, am I going to be able to stand back and go, hey, you know what? I'm proud of that. I'm glad I did that. And no, I didn't go at it half-ass. I think that's what it comes down to. You know, because anything that I sign up for besides Dream Theater, I'm always, you know, no matter who the artist is that's coming up to me, whether it be Arjen Lucassen or Tim Donahue, which I did Madmen and Sinners with, I always feel out that musician. I want to see what is their style, what kind of music are you talking about writing with me, or that you want me to be involved in. And that if I'm, you know, because I have to be, you know, let's face it, anything you do, I'm sure you have to say, hey, you know, I got to be in here for the right reasons.
Of course, sure.
You know, I got to believe in the music and I got to want to be, and I am excited to be a part of it. And I guess that's what it comes down to. But it's definitely, you know, a juggling act at times because you're involved in so much. And then meanwhile, you still got your domestic part of your life going. But, you know,
of course, so,
yeah, it's a little difficult at times, but I've seemed to keep the balance so far.
Of course. Well, with your project Mo Muzzler, which is, you know, your solo project but had a name, the second album came out on 9/11, isn't that right?
Yeah,
that
I know.
Must have been such a surreal day for you in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it definitely was. And at the same time, if you remember too, the Scenes from New York, our DVD, Dream Theater came out too.
Oh, it's the same day?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And if you go back to that, Shane, the original front cover is the Twin Towers on fire. So what do you think of that?
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. It's a collector's item. We had to pull it. We called our label right away and said, you know, in good taste, that needs to be pulled. Like, who could have predicted that?
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. That's weird, man.
Yeah, so the fans went out on a scramble and picked up as many of those the album cover, the original album covers, as they could, because within a week it was pulled from the shelves and then a new cover came out.
Yeah, I just pulled it up. So I just pulled it up on my computer right here. Yeah, it's got it. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's got the it's got the apple. Right, the apple with the barbed wire around it. On fire with the Statue of Liberty and the Twin Towers, live scenes from New York, and it came
crazy?
Out. That is that is crazy.
That's right. We were like, you know, our jaws were on the floor, going, "What the fuck just happened here?" And to be just a story for you, there, I flew in to New York the night before September 10th. I flew into New York because September 11th, I was supposed to start recording the vocals for Six Degrees of Inner Turbulence. And I woke up to that. I actually bumped into a guy that used to tour manage for us. Bill Barkley was staying at the same hotel. He bumped into me in the lobby and said, "Hey, do you want to get together for breakfast the next day?" I said, "Sure, call me in the morning." He called me, but he called me waking me up going, "James, put your freaking TV on. You're not going to believe what's going on." He said, "A plane just flew in one of the Twin Towers." And as we were on the phone together talking, we watched the second plane hit.
Wow. So where in New York were you staying?
I was at right around 42nd Street and Broadway.
Oh, my God. So, yeah. Geez, like you were like 2 miles away.
Exactly.
That's unbelievable.
And the thing is it felt like, you know, like the end of the world like had happened, because we were able to walk down Fifth Avenue. So about an hour, 2 hours later, we were walking down Fifth Avenue, and the only cars on the road were taxis. And then the mayor came out, and there was an announcement, and he said, "Okay, everyone has 12 hours. If you leave the island, you don't come back. The only vehicles that are going to be allowed back in will be, food and whatever else, any of the other amenities that are necessary, right?" And every 15, 20 minutes, you'd hear three F-18 jets flying overhead. And it was just unbelievable, man. It was you couldn't believe it. You thought you were dreaming. Yeah, it's just
did you stay there? And
yeah, I stayed there. Wow. So I had an opportunity. Our producer at the time who was working with us was Kevin Shirley, and he lived there. And he said, "Hey, man, you know, if you want to take my car and go home, you can go for it," because, you know, obviously there was no flights out of there. But
yeah,
so I checked into the border crossing right around like the Peace Bridge and, you know, several. And the average wait was 12 and a half hours.
Yeah.
And I went, I'm staying. You know, I got in touch with my wife and that, and I let her know I was fine. And she said, "Just stay put. Just stay there, man." You know? And that's what I did. But yeah, it was crazy time, man. Crazy time.
That is a crazy time. Wow. Yeah. Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time, but thanks for this awesome conversation. I want to ask you about your son and your son's music. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so Chance, he's the drummer, my son, and it's a band called Falsette, and they just released their EP. Here We Are, and I think it's fantastic. I think the music's amazing. It's all original. They're a great band. They're a great band. It's very heavy, but melodically driven. Great melodies, and everybody in the band is a great player. So, you know, I see good things happening. They're actually going to do one show in Toronto on the Warped Tour.
Oh, nice.
So
my band will be there as well.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. We're playing that day. Yeah.
So there you go. They're going to be doing that. And then they're playing in a couple weeks. They're starting to do, I think, 6 or 7 gigs, some down in Toronto and that. But they're getting more and more active, and they're working on new material at the moment. So hopefully they'll have a new album out sometime in 2019. Cool. And that's it, you know.
Did you push your son towards playing drums? I know you were a drummer originally.
Yeah, man. I played drums from the age of 5 to 17. And I'm glad I did it, because rhythmically it just gave me an amazing rhythmic sense, right? And then look at the band that I ended up in. So thank God I did that, you know, because I just naturally feel time signatures. I mean, you know, right. Yeah, somebody can be standing there going 1 2 3 4 5 6 1 2 3 1 2 3 4 5, you know, but to me, it's just, I'm feeling it, right? I'm just feeling it. And I think I owe that all to the fact that I had 12 years behind a kit going crazy and feeling everything rhythmically. And I think that's what's really kind of kept me completely tapped in when it comes to any kind of music, for that matter. And
what was the hardest song that, you know, someone else in your band wrote, like whether it was Petrucci or Mike, any of the Mikes or whatever,
when they wrote it that you were like, what the fuck? Like, like, or you're in the studio and you're trying to sing this, whether it's a rhythm or a melody. Do you have any that stick out in your mind that were just so hard to wrap your head around?
Illumination Theory, like that kind of has its moments.
Yeah.
Where it just gets really freaking very, very, very complicated. With its time signatures, and then where I'm, coming in and out, in and out, in and out. It's really kind of funky.
Sure.
And that's, so I really had to like batten down the hatches there and really think about that, especially when I was in the studio initially singing it, singing those sections.
Exactly.
I like, hang on, I want to feel this naturally, or it's going to feel like I'm a freaking robot. It'll get 1, 2, go. 1, 2,
like that. I love a moment when you're in the studio, you're in the booth, and obviously, like the other people in the control room, like let's say you can see them through the glass window, they're in a different place, different headspace than you're in, because you got to think about the words, timing, singing in key, and I love when there's like okay, and everyone points where you're supposed to come in.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to help you?
Yeah, I know, right?
Like,
yeah.
It was right there. Come on, Larry.
I don't know if you've had this happen, Shane, but what about it? Just you're so caught up in what you're doing, and then you say, okay, hang on, stop. Let me listen back to that. Okay, yeah, so let me try another take on that. And you know exactly where you come in, but then you're talking to the people in the engineer room, right? And then it comes up, and they go, okay, so let's go for this. And then the moment comes and goes by, and you're completely gapped out.
all the time.
Right? And then you go, oh, my God, man, I was totally somewhere else. They go, let's try that again, But it's just fun, all those little moments in the studio,
Because, I know.
Yeah, because it's high focus, and it's just bound to happen. You're going to have your moments where you're like, okay, I wasn't there.
Yeah, there's no question. All right, man. Well, thanks. What's next for Dream Theater? Next for you? What's coming up?
Yeah. So Dream Theater, we're going to start back in the studio in June. And we'll just all be together and writing and working on the new album. So we're hoping that the album will be out, let's say, February of 2019. And then we're looking at this point that we'd start the next world tour next March.
Perfect.
And then as far as myself, like I said, I'm working on another solo album. And actually, I take off on April 17th. I'm flying down to South America, and I'm going to do 4 shows with a band called Nocturnal.
Okay.
They're like a heavy metal band down there. They're a huge band down in South America. But they've asked me to come in, and I'm going to sing 5 songs a night, 2 Dream Theater songs, 2 solo songs, and then I'm going to share the vocal duties with their vocalist, Diego, on one of their songs. So it's just going to be a fun gig. And
yeah, it sounds a little different.
Yeah, so it'd be like 4 shows. I'm just going to fly and boom, 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 be done, and then come back, chill out, and then, like I said, in June, get back in the studio with the DT guys.
Sounds great, James. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Good luck with everything with the family life and your son's band. And man, I'll see you around. Maybe I'll see you at the Warped Tour if you're around.
Yeah, likewise to you, Shane.
All right,
thanks.
Man. All right, the best. Take care. Yeah, take care.
Great, bye.
So there it is with James. What a great guy. Amazing episode. Thank you so much to James for doing this. And of course, to James' son's band and his friend who somehow hooked us up. Very, very cool. It's amazing how these things work. If you like the show, if you want to support what I'm doing, please feel free to go on iTunes and rate the show, preferably 5 stars, write a review. Make sure you're subscribed. And of course, if you want more, check out the All Access Club at leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. And tell a friend, tell a loved one. I think word of mouth really is what'll help this thing grow. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Before I let you go, we're going to play a Dream Theater tune, and there are so many great ones to choose from. I was listening to Images and Words this week, and I haven't listened to it in a while. It's a great record. And yes, Pull Me Under is a song that started it all. So once you listen to this song, if you like it, go and check that one out. But I'm going to play Metropolis Part 1, The Miracle and The Sleeper. It's about 8.5 minutes, so get ready.
but it's a great tune. Here it is on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. See you next week.